willing, we'll preach from this chapter again this evening, but just like to read the first four verses, Nehemiah chapter 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. And it came to pass in the month of Chislu, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the palace, that a Hanani, one of my brethren, came and had certain men of Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews that escaped, which were left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also was broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. And it came to pass, when I heard these words, that I sat down and wept and mourned certain days, and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Of the historical books of the Bible, the most recent in date are the books of Ezra, Esther, and Nehemiah. The first six chapters of the book of Nehemiah are basically the record of the reconstruction of the walls of Jerusalem. By way of background leading to the book of Nehemiah, the city of Jerusalem, of course, passed into the hands of the Jews under David, who made it the capital of his kingdom. To secure his position, David built a wall around the city of Jerusalem. We know that in the reign of Solomon, that this wall was greatly strengthened. Its height was increased. Large towers were built upon it. And for nearly two centuries, the wall remained intact, serving as a boundary, serving as protection for the city of Jerusalem. It had sustained several sieges, but we're told in 2 Kings 14 and verse 13 that during the reign of Amaziah, a 600-foot breach was made in the wall. Many years later, during the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah, we know that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, with his mighty armies, invaded Jerusalem. Notice in second, with that in mind, notice 2 Chronicles 36. 2 Chronicles 36 and verse 19. This is Nebuchadnezzar's coming into Jerusalem. And they burnt the house of God and break down the wall of Jerusalem and burnt all the palaces thereof with fire and destroyed all the goodly vessels thereof. They break down the wall of Jerusalem. And we know that Nebuchadnezzar and his armies took many of the people, what they would have considered the best or the most promising of the Jews, they took them into captivity. This captivity lasted 70 years. And then the Babylonian power was broken by the Persian Empire. Cyrus was the king of Persia, and we read that God stirred the heart of Cyrus, the king of Persia, causing him to encourage these Jews that had been taken captive to return to their homeland. And from Ezra chapter 2, we see that some 50,000 Jews did indeed return. And they began the immense task of rebuilding the temple. But after a couple years, they would become discouraged by the opposition from the people who had settled in their homeland during these 70 years. And as a result of their discouragement, they abandoned the work of rebuilding the temple with only the foundation complete at this time. About 16 years later, all we have here is the foundation of this temple. About 16 years later, after these Jews had rebuilt their houses and were living really by this time quite comfortable lives, God raised up two men by the name of Haggai and Zechariah. And these two men challenged the people concerning their way of life, pointed to the fact that they had rebuilt their own houses and the temple of God was still in waste. And God used the ministry of Haggai and Zechariah to convict and to inspire the people to once again commence the work of rebuilding the temple. So now we're 20 years from when these first Jews returned by the time the temple is being rebuilt. The first six chapters of Ezra record the rebuilding of the temple. About 60 years later, another group of Jews would return to their homeland under the leadership of Ezra. And they found that though the temple had been rebuilt, the people were in a state of spiritual and moral poverty due to the fact that they had intermarried with unbelievers of the surrounding nations and had become caught up in their pagan lifestyles. Ezra, he sets about to reestablish the moral and spiritual life of the people. That really should have been done before the temple was rebuilt. That's another message. The temple's been rebuilt. Ezra now endeavoring to restore the spiritual health of the people meets with opposition on every hand. And this is recorded in Ezra chapter 7 through 10. So there's basically 60 years between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7. And in that time frame, you say, well, what happened in those 60 years? Enter the book of Esther. Between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7, you have the book of Esther. By the time we get to the book of Nehemiah, about 90 years have passed since the first group of Jews under Cyrus were allowed to return to their homeland. In other words, it's now been 160 years since Nebuchadnezzar and the armies of Babylon had invaded Jerusalem and torn down the walls. 160 years later, and the walls are still in shambles. No wall. Nehemiah, in our text, was in the palace of the king of Persia, serving the king. We read in verse 2 that Hanani and certain men of Judah came to Shushan. And Nehemiah asked them a question concerning the people in Jerusalem. He basically said, "How are things going? How are things going in the land?" And in verse 3, they told Nehemiah of the situation. "They said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down." That is, it remains torn down. "And the gates thereof are burned with fire." They reported to Nehemiah. They said, "Nehemiah, things are a mess. It's a mess in Jerusalem. It's a real mess." We read in verse 4 of Nehemiah's response. "And it came to pass when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned certain days and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven." I want to speak this morning on a God for the messes of life. As soon as Nehemiah heard of the mess, he went to God. He knew God. Now notice, first of all, the description of the situation. We see that in verse 3. The report was very grim, very dismal and dire report. Concerning the people, it is said that they are in great, that is, a considerable amount of affliction. They are in great affliction. They are in a considerable amount of suffering and distress. They are suffering pain and trouble, misery, sorrow, and torment. And then it says, "and reproach." That is, they are disgrace and shameful. The condition of the people is one of disgrace. The condition of the people is one of shame. Concerning Jerusalem, it is said, the wall of Jerusalem, and then notice, also. That is, in addition to the condition of the people, the wall of Jerusalem is, or the wall of Jerusalem remains broken down. The wall is still shattered. It's still broken. It's still crushed in pieces. And the gates thereof are burned with fire. In other words, Nehemiah, the people are not doing well at all. In fact, it's an absolute disgrace. And the walls are in the same condition that Nebuchadnezzar left them 160 years ago. Concerning the condition of the city, we read in chapter 2 and verse 3, "The place of my father's sepulchres lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire." Chapter 2, verse 17. "Then said I unto them, ye see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire." Chapter 4, verse 2. This is the enemy speaking concerning the city. "And he spake before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, what do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of the rubbish?" So we get a picture. The city is in waste. There are heaps or piles of rubbish. In chapter 4 and verse 10, the strength of the bearers of burdens is decayed, and there is much rubbish. So scattered and strewn about Jerusalem is broken rock, splinters of charred wood. We have here a picture of a disaster. We have a picture of destruction. Absolute ruin. Debris everywhere. Mere fragments of what was once very beautiful. What we see here is an absolute mess. Piles of rubbish. Everything is in total disarray. And as you view the situation, we need to keep in mind that this is not merely the result of the actions of Nebuchadnezzar, but it is the result of sin. It is a result of the sin of a people. It's very easy to say, Nebuchadnezzar did this. You walk through the mess. Nebuchadnezzar did this. Nebuchadnezzar was only a tool of God to bring forth the judgment of God. The walls torn down. The mess is not Nebuchadnezzar's fault. The mess is the result of sin. And not just sin in general. But it is the result of the sin of a people who were called by God. It was a result of the sins of God's people. The result of the sin of a people who had been blessed with God's presence and God's word. A people who had been given great opportunity to serve God. So we need to observe the ruins in Jerusalem. And we see the results of a people. Again, you can read their history throughout the Old Testament. You can read the messages that the prophets of God delivered to them. And what we're seeing here in this mess is a result of a people who took the blessings of God for granted and would not hear the prophets of God and did not take the message of God seriously. In fact, they disregarded the ways of God and they chose the ways of man, moving further and further and further away from God, dismissing God from every aspect of their life, and putting more and more esteem upon fleshly and worldly things than the things of God. Observe the ruins and see the results of a people who no longer had the right loyalties in their lives. And again, we're more concerned about the earthly than the spiritual. And pursued the earthly more eagerly than they did the spiritual. You read verse 3 of Nehemiah 1. And what we see here is the disastrous results of a life lived apart from God. You can walk through the rubbish with Nehemiah in chapter 2. And you can see and feel the results of a people who in their pride sinned against God. without any shame, and with a hardened heart. And as you observe the ruins, you see the results. Again, the prophets preached on this over and over again. You see the results of a mere semblance, a mere form, a mere shadow of a relationship with God. And the results where the will and the worship and the service of God were simply a sideline or an afterthought. Reading the history of Israel in the Old Testament is like reading United States history. Observe the ruins and see the results of mere ceremony and creed and the mere display and formality of religion. See the results of a mere surface religion. As a result of all of this, we read verse 3. And we see that which is broken, shattered, scattered. What a mess. As you look at that city, what a mess. But it's what is described in verse 3. We've all seen pictures. We remember 9/11, the pictures. We've seen pictures of destruction in war. We've seen pictures of destruction, tornadoes, hurricanes. There is no picture that can compare to the damage that the sins of God's people have caused. There is no picture that can compare to the destruction, the ruin, the loss that sin has caused. No picture that can compare to the havoc and the misery and the heartache of sin. If we could only get that picture engraved in our mind, the picture of what sin has caused. Nothing has brought to the lives of individuals and to society itself more destruction than sin. We are reminded all through the Word of God in a variety of ways that there's nothing more dreadful than sin. There's nothing more degrading. There's nothing more decimating to man, to mankind, than sin. It is against man's comfort. Is against man's joy. Man sins for comfort. Man sins for joy. And yet every sin is against man's comfort. And every sin is against his joy. Every sin is against his peace and tranquility of mind. It is against the overall good of man. All the mess that sin causes. In addition to the disarray that sin causes, there are the everyday needs that just come about. The everyday cares and difficulties and problems. Notice the response of Nehemiah. When Nehemiah heard the words of verse 3, we read of his response in verse 4. What we see here is a godly response to the news. to the news of a mess. What we see here is the godly response to a great need. What we see here is a spiritual reaction to a literal mess. There are a few points in his response. We're going to look at those tonight. But we only want to focus upon one today. Notice in verse 4 that following the hearing of the situation, we are told five things that Nehemiah did. He sat down. He wept. He mourned. He fasted. And he prayed. Five things that Nehemiah did. But the key to each of those actions is found in the last phrase of the verse. Before the God of heaven. I sat down before the God of heaven. I wept before the God of heaven. I mourned before the God of heaven. I fasted before the God of heaven. I prayed before the God of heaven. What does that mean? It means that Nehemiah was now in the presence of God. Nehemiah is now in the presence of God. Nehemiah is fully aware of the reality of God. I did all of these things before the God of heaven. He has recognized and he has acknowledged God. There are a lot of messes. You don't have to go outside these doors to see the messes. All you have to do is look in the mirror. Every church in America, every church in the world is filled with a mess. There's messes everywhere. What should we do? Recognize and acknowledge God. That's what Nehemiah did. He is persuaded. He is confident in God. He's sitting. He's weeping. He's mourning. He's fasting. He's praying before God. He's persuaded that God is there. He's convicted that he's in the presence of God. Nehemiah knows, on the one hand, is a very serious and pressing and desperate situation. On the one hand, there's that which is broken and shattered. On the one hand, there's ruins and upheaval and chaos and failure and defeat and disappointment. On the one hand, there's torment and misery and distress. On the one hand, there are insurmountable problems and needs. And where do we find Nehemiah? Before the God of heaven. Before the God of heaven. It doesn't just say before God, because that could leave you with much imagination. But it says before the God of heaven. He is in the presence. And he is aware. He is before the one who reigns supreme. He is before the one who excels everything. He is before the one that excels the mess that is down in Jerusalem. He is before him. and all the messes of life, we need to get before the one who excels all the messes of life. So there he is, before the God of heaven, before the one who created the world by just speaking, before the one who rolled back the Red Sea and brought Israel over on dry ground, before the one who miraculously fed Israel for over 40 years with bread from heaven, before the one who provided water from a rock for his people, before the one who led the children of Israel through the wilderness, before the one who turned the bitter waters into sweet, before the one who brought down the walls of Jericho, before the one who gave victory to Gideon and his 300 men, before the one who caused David to defeat Goliath. And you know, you look at all those Bible stories. It's not about David defeating Goliath. It's not about Gideon. They're all stories about God. We lose sight of that. Oh, tell me the story of David and Goliath. The story of David and Goliath, like all the other stories, are stories of God. We need to remember that. And here's Nehemiah before the God of heaven, before the one who increased the widow woman's oil and who delivered Israel from the 70-year captivity, before the one who would walk with the three Hebrews in the fiery furnace. There he sits, weeping, mourning, fasting, and praying in the presence of God. Tell you what, there's a big difference between being sad over something and laying down in your bed and weeping and doing it before the Lord. Big difference. Big difference. You just go home and weep because your life's a mess, you're going to get depressed. But you get in the presence of God and weep and mourn and fast and pray. It'll make a difference. Our lives, our families, their marriages, their homes, careers, circumstances, all of these things, anything in our life can become a mess. But there is a God. There is a God who can still and still does part the waters. There is a God who still has bread for your every need. There is a God who can still bring water from a rock. There is a God who can still take the bitter and make it sweet. There is a God who still knows the way through the wilderness. There is a God who is still greater than any wall that the enemies may erect. And there is still a God who uses the few and feeble, as he did with Gideon. And there is a God who still topples giants, as he did with David. And there is a God who's still able to give increase, as he did with the widow woman. And there is a God who can still deliver from the worst of captivities. And there is still a God who will meet you. He'll not only meet you there, he'll walk with you in the fiery furnace. There is a God. In spite of all the messes of life, there is a God who's still a hiding place from the wind. There is still a God who is a covert from the tempest. There is still a God who is rivers of water in a dry land and the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. We need to get before the God of heaven. He's a God who still gives power to the faint. He is a God who can still open rivers in high places. That's a miracle. You don't see rivers in high places. But God can open rivers in high places. He can open fountains in the midst of valleys. And He can make the wilderness a pool of water. And He can bring springs out of the dry land where no water is. There is a God who can still make the crooked straight, however crooked it may be. And there is still a God who can smooth the rocky roads. And there is still a God who will hold your hand and will carry you and will shepherd you. And this God has green pastures, and He has green pastures for you, and He has still waters, and He can restore your soul, and He can lead you in right paths, and He can walk with you through the valley of the shadow of death, and He can comfort you, and He can anoint you until your cup runs over. Whatever it is that may be broken, whatever it is that may be shattered, whatever there is that is in ruins today, behold, there is a God for all the messes of life. Back there in Nehemiah 4, I believe it was verse 2, we see the enemy. What will these feeble Jews do? Do they think they're going to revive the stones out of the rubbish? It's like people today that says, it's all ruins. There's no hope. Whatever the mess in your life or my life, whatever the mess might be, there is a God who is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that you ask or think. Whatever the mess is, do not give up on God. Acknowledge the God who can straighten any mess. He is able, however dark it might be, He's able to bring light. However weak we may be, He is able to bring strength. However defeated we might be, He is able to bring victory. However chaotic things might be, He is able to bring order. However much turmoil your soul might be in, He is able to bring peace. However the storms may rage, He is able to bring calm. However great the sorrow, He is able to bring joy. However great and extensive the emptiness, there's fullness in God. However strong the bondage, He has freedom that you need. As we've said before, there's nothing broken that He cannot mend. He can. So there's Nehemiah. And we need to learn from Nehemiah. On the one hand, there's shambles, but there he is before the God of heaven. And you read through Nehemiah chapter 1, you'll see that he pleaded with God. He recognized the character of God. He pleaded the promise of God. He acknowledged God's great work of salvation. And he just kept on praying. kept on pleading. There is a miracle-working God for all the messes of life. And the best place for you and I to spend our life in the midst of all the mess is before the God of heaven. I want to tell you the worst thing you can do in the midst of a mess is forsake God. Nehemiah sat before the God of heaven. When was the last time you just sat before the God of heaven? He sat before the God of heaven, he wept and he mourned before the God of heaven. He fasted and he prayed before the God of heaven. This is where we need to live, before the God of heaven. Living in the awareness of the reality of God. Sitting before the God of heaven and doing all of these things that Nehemiah did, that's not where you get discouraged. That's where you get encouraged. Sitting before the God of heaven. Who are we sitting before today? And we've got mess. The world may be in the biggest mess it's ever been in. There's not a doubt in my mind that the United States of America is in the biggest mess it's ever been in. But what are God's people doing? Do we sit before the God of heaven? There's the answer. Sitting before the God of heaven. Brother Larry, if you'd come and lead us verse song. Let's all stand. Brother Larry will lead us in singing.